DW Deutsche Welle. World in Progress.
This week on the show, Turkish parents are concerned as secular schools are being turned into religious schools.
Nobody wants this. We want our children to be educated following the principles of secularism. Until now it was like this, and we were happy. The teachers are gone, the system is changing, and the mentality is changing.
Canadians protest against Prime Minister Harper's cuts to social and environmental programs.
Most Canadians are unhappy with the current government. If you look at polls, more than 90% of Canadians believe in climate change and think that it's human-induced and want policies in place to stop that process.
And the movie Call Me Kuchu sheds light on the plight of gays in Uganda.
Yesterday, gay rights activist David Katoche Sulu was attacked at his home by unknown assailants.
Hello and welcome to World in Progress. I'm Sarah Steffen, standing in for Anke Raspa this week. In Turkey, many parents got a surprise this month with the start of the new school year when they discovered the children's school had been turned into a religious school. The imam hatibs, as they are called, were originally created to teach future imams. But now, under controversial education reforms, which were introduced by the Islamist-rooted government, even secular schools are being converted into religious imam hatibs, as Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
At the Mehmet Akif Middle School, parents are waiting to collect their children. But the start of the school year brought a shock for many.
It was a surprise. The former director had told us they wouldn't change the school. But when we came to register, we learned that they had already converted it to a religious school.
But the change from a secular school to a religious imam hatip is causing divisions among the parents. For this mother, who's wearing a headscarf in accordance to Islam, welcomed the change.
We are a Muslim country and imam hatips are for teaching our religion. It is important for my child. I want my child to learn about his religion. All this criticism is an exaggeration because we are a Muslim country, so religion must be a part of our education. The curriculum is basically the same, but they will add courses about the life of our Prophet and about Quran. It is important for me that my child grows up learning his religion during his studies.
But this father is deeply concerned for the future of his daughter's education.
They will say, put a headscarf on your child, and she will have to wear a longer dress. They will try to bring more backwardness into their lives. Nobody wants this. We want our children to be educated following the principles of secularism. Until now it was like this, and we were happy. The teachers are gone, the system is changing, and the mentality is changing.
Imam hatips like this one of the oldest in Istanbul, which taught the Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan, were originally set up to teach imams. But the schools that combine a normal education with hours of religious education, most of which is studying and reciting the Quran, have become popular with Turkey's largely religious population. Combining religious education, like this Quran recital class, along with a normal curriculum, means an arduous workload for the children, with on average an extra 2 or 3 hours of studying a day. Imam Hatip education starts at the age of 9. But for 14-year-old Mehmet, he has no complaints.
I want to go to the music conservatory. I don't want to become an imam. But religious education is important to me. I see it as education in life, so I don't see it as extra work. I am happy to learn it.
Mehmet's teacher, Azmi Duan, says Imam Hatips serve an important role for the country's pious community.
The students here get educated in every field of Islamic study, whether it's the interpretations of Islam, as well as the Prophet's words. They learn Arabic to understand the Quran in its original writing, so every child who leaves here is qualified to become an imam or a religious official. For the pupils, this is not a problem, as their parents want their children brought up like this.
But since Imam Hatibs were introduced in the 1950s, they've been a controversial topic in the debate over Turkey's secular state. In the 1990s, as part of the pro-secular military-inspired crackdown on the country's Islamic movement, many of the schools were shut down. But Assistant Professor of Sociology Kenan Jair of Istanbul's Bilgi University claims the school's combination of modern education with religion can be positive.
They promote an understanding that religion does not necessarily conflict with modernity. So religion and modernity can be together. This is very controversial in Turkey, because in Turkish modernity, classical, times, secular civilization and narrative, it is, argued that religion does necessarily conflict with modernity. So we have to leave religion behind.
The Islamist-rooted government claim the Imam Hatip expansion is just about restoring the schools that were closed down in the 1990s. But such claims have done little to curtail the growing anger among parents. In this latest protest outside of a newly converted school, parents claim the government is imposing religion on their children. Under new regulations introduced by the government, changing schools is extremely difficult. In Istanbul alone, 67 secular schools have been converted to Imam Hatips, many in staunchly secular parts of the city. Ali Boa, a member of parliament for the ruling AK party, indicated these recent Imam Hatip expansions could be just the beginning.
We are here as Imam Hatip graduates, or as allies. We will increase the number of these schools in records. We have the chance to turn all schools into Imam Hatip schools.
The government refused to deny they have such plans. Instead, Prime Minister Erdogan slammed critics of the schools, while his education minister said opponents of the reforms were either terrorist supporters or fanatical secularists. In such a political climate, compromise will be hard to find, which could condemn education to become the latest battleground over the future of the Turkish secular state. Dorian Jones, DW, Istanbul.
Canada's Prime Minister Stephen Harper is in New York City this week to receive the Statesman of the Year award from the Appeal of Conscience Foundation. However, few Canadians are celebrating. Quite the contrary. Many Canadians are taking to the streets and voicing their anger against Harper and his conservative policies. Policies, they say, are changing the face of Canada at home and abroad. Since Harper came to power in 2006, he has imposed hefty cuts on social and environmental programs. Tanya Castle has more from Canada's capital, Ottawa.
On the footsteps of Canada's parliament last week, about 200 people chant, "Stephen Harper's got to go," wear pins stating, "Stephen Harper hates me," and hold placards reading, "Stop Harper and we are all affected," referring to the deep government cuts to social programs across the country. The protesters included union leaders, environmentalists, human rights activists, organic farming supporters, and anti-poverty activists. One of the protesters was Obert Madondo, a political activist from Zimbabwe who found refuge in Canada. Madondo says he's against the current government's handling of criticism and dissent.
I'm here on a journey that I would call an underground railroad journey. I left Zimbabwe because of my political involvement. I had for years been involved in the fight against the dictatorship of Robert Mugabe. And then I came to Canada and I thought, as a new immigrant, this was going to be home for me. But over the last couple of years, it has ceased to be a home. I've experienced the same violence that I experienced in Zimbabwe. And that made me want to get involved in the political conversation, also in the activism that tries to bring back democracy to Canada.
Another protester, 73-year-old artist Linda Luno, is concerned about the cuts to social programs.
Well, I'm here today because I am watching one program after another being destroyed. There's just so many things. And now they want to introduce another bill that they're going to lump everything together in, and how much are we going to lose again?
Since taking office in 2006, Prime Minister Stephen Harper and his Conservative Party have cut funding to several social programs. They shut down the International Center for Human Rights and Democratic Development, a think tank that promoted democracy and monitored human rights, and the Court Challenges Program, a program that helped fund court challenges to discriminatory laws. They also slashed funding to the Canadian Human Rights Commission and Status of Women Canada, resulting in office closures for both, as well as benefits for the old and unemployed. Environmental programs have also been hit. Funds for conservation programs such as fisheries protection were sliced, and the number of environment reviews of large-scale natural resource projects limited. The government claims the cuts were necessary to protect Canada's economy and move the country forward as an energy supplier.
Next up, we have Brent Talbot. Now, there's a group of walkers who've been walking here since May Day.
Protest MC Lana Goldberg, a member of Occupy Toronto and political science student at York University, says the cuts imposed by Harper are an assault on Canada's values and people.
There's so many issues. This man is changing the face of Canada and taking it in an extreme right-wing direction. But I think mostly it's the disregard for the environment. So this last omnibus budget bill killed environmental regulation, research, and monitoring. This regime has been approving pipelines and other mining projects with complete disregard for Indigenous communities. I mean, it's just atrocious what's happening right now, and I felt like we needed to make a stand, let this regime know that we are paying attention and we're not going to stand for it.
More than 50 pieces of environment regulation were amended by the last omnibus budget bill. Tony Clark, the executive director of the Polaris Institute, a social justice group, says the bill was designed to expedite the government's economic vision for Canada.
The whole thing is designed to completely overhaul the environment laws and protections and rules in this country to make it possible for these big resource development projects to be rammed through. And the reason for that is, according to the government anyway, is that this government has put a huge priority in the Canadian economy on our role as a resource supplier for the global economy.
Indigenous groups and the provincial government of British Columbia stand in the way of some of the projects. Pipelines that would carry bitumen from Alberta's tar sands through British Columbia's wilderness and Indigenous land to the Pacific coast are being legally challenged by several First Nations groups. Internationally, Canada has taken several steps to advance its energy agenda as well. They have not gone unnoticed. This year, global civil society and international diplomats singled Canada out for its disruptive behavior and destructive policies on energy and extraction at the Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro, adding to the criticism of Canada's decision to withdraw from the Kyoto Accord. Occupy Toronto's Goldberg says most Canadians disagree with the government's current environmental policy.
Most Canadians are unhappy with the current government. If you look at polls, more than 90% of Canadians believe in climate change and think that it's human-induced and want policies in place to stop that process. And they want to see a clean environment. They want to have a planet to live on.
Madondo summarizes the attitude of many Canadians more bluntly.
The recent award announced by a New York-based organization, which is to be awarded to Stephen Harper, the Statesman of the Year Award. It's an insult to Canadians, but it's also an insult to the values that we hold dear, because in the last year alone, the Harper government has put into place legislation, policies, and measures and propaganda that's going to radically change this country for generations to come. Not only this country, but the environment, First Nations communities, everything. And for somebody to have the audacity to say Harper is Statesman of the Year for 2012 is just an unforgivable insult. It's unbelievable.
He and others pledge to continue their efforts to stop Harper and his policies. Tanya Castle, DW, Ottawa, Canada.
Then I come on. all you creatures who agree with their far living with me. That's gonna tear down what all these...
Remember, you can find more stories on development and globalization online at our website dw.de/globalization. Neglected tropical diseases, a group of debilitating and sometimes deadly infections like rabies, leprosy and trachoma, are affecting more than 1 billion people worldwide, mainly those living in remote rural areas, urban slums or conflict zones. The World Health Organization lists 17 diseases as neglected tropical diseases, or NTDs. Most of those are considered ancient diseases that have been largely wiped out, but unfortunately not in all parts of the world. Earlier, I spoke to Ghana's former president, John Kufuor, special envoy for the Global Network for Neglected Tropical Diseases. Mr. Kufuor, more than 1 billion people worldwide are affected by neglected tropical diseases. That's 1 in 6 people. Why are these diseases neglected if so many are affected?
They are so common and so general in the poorest parts of the world, including Africa, much of Africa, Asia, and Latin America. And so even as the world pays so much attention to HIV, AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria, somehow not much attention is given to these diseases that are all over the place, afflicting the most of people.
But is it because it's the world's poor who are affected that these diseases have been forgotten, that because they have no purchasing power?
Well, that could be a contributory factor. But as you observed, in many societies, the poor tend to be marginalized. They tend to be in remote areas, and they don't tend to have a voice.
Which disease of the 17 would you say is the most dangerous one, maybe for Ghana?
They're all dangerous. Being overcome by blindness is really like being condemned. People afflicted by elephantiasis or the swelling of the lymph or whatever, that too really would even limit person from moving. Can you imagine a subsistence farmer in some remote part scratching the land for a living? Being afflicted with elephantiasis, that would disable him from moving. So how would he live? How would he go to the farm? Or if it's some child that is afflicted, how does he go to school? How can he even pay attention to learn? So all these are important, I believe. And fortunately, it takes like one packet of pills, assorted pills, to fight all these diseases together.
How did you do it in Ghana? How did you tackle neglected tropical diseases there?
Well, I assumed presidency in 2001, stayed in power for 8 years. It occurred to my government that a disease like Guinea worm, that was quite prevalent in certain parts of the country, could be eradicated. Fortunately for my government, we had international partners like the Carter Group that voluntarily came and helped government in its efforts to provide good potable water for as many people as possible, even in remote parts of the country. And then a contribution of the needed medicines, the pills and vaccines from pharmaceutical societies. And then the government's own efforts. My government launched the National Health Insurance Scheme with a very affordable premium so all people could access. And even those who couldn't access, the state assumed responsibility to cover them. By the time I was leaving office 2008, Guinea worm was virtually eradicated. And again, enhanced knowledge enabled people, including some of the very poor, to know that they shouldn't depend on untreated stagnant waters for drinking. Some of the diseases to attack from contaminated soils. So knowledge, spread of knowledge, and social support.
But what about vaccines? Are there enough vaccines and medicines available to prevent and treat these diseases?
We get a lot of help from pharmaceuticals that companies from around the world. For instance, with the campaign I'm helping to advocate, we learned that with as little as 50 United States cents support in terms of provision of the drugs and medicines per head in a year, we can really eliminate and even in many cases also eradicate some of these diseases.
In addition to treating people, isn't it also important to include animals, for instance, to stop the spreading of rabies?
It's important, but again, that's a function of knowledge. You have large groups of poor communities which tend to be ignorant. People may not be aware of the diseases that come about through infected animals. So education and information again, and this should be pushed by governments and by international organizations, civil society organizations, so more and more people would know. And those who would want to keep pets like dogs and cats would then know the necessity to vaccinate or treat the dogs or pets from time to time so they do not become agencies for the spread.
Right, and like you said, I mean, knowledge is key, but yes. Of course they also have to be able to afford the vaccines.
Yes, and I believe if when governments address themselves to this facility, governments should be able to afford or at least subsidize the efforts of people, their efforts to resist the spread of the diseases.
What are the next steps to get rid of all the 17 diseases in the future?
Internationally, I believe the UN agencies like WHO should be backing a global campaign. Of course, there should be non-governmental organizations and civil society organizations, and there should be national efforts at government levels, local government levels, through schools, public health organizations. All these agencies should, I believe, hold together.
I spoke to Ghana's former president, John Kufuor, special envoy for the Global Network for Neglected Tropical Diseases. The network aims to eradicate 7 of these 17 NTDs by 2020. Ugandan officials arrest a British theatre producer for staging a play about a gay man. A man from Cameroon is jailed for sending a gay text message. Homophobia is widespread in Uganda, and gay men and women frequently face harassment and violence. Shocking headlines about the persecution of the lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender or LGBT community in Africa are not new. But it's hard to get insight into the lives of the people involved. A documentary about Ugandan LGBT activists, one of whom was murdered last year, tries to do just that. DW's Chiponna Chimbilu saw the documentary Call Me Kuchu on the first day of its cinema run in Germany.
Today may be a weekday, but you would think a Hollywood blockbuster was premiering at this Bonn movie house.
There's a way you feel when you know you're unwanted. That's how I feel.
It's the start of a cinema run in Germany for Call Me Kuchu, a documentary about the struggle of the Ugandan lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender or LGBT community.
There's no longer a debate in Uganda. We don't recognize homosexuality as a human right here.
The anti-homosexuality bill, which was tabled in Parliament, proposes life imprisonment for gay activity and death for aggravated homosexuality.
Kuchu is what the Ugandan LGBT community calls itself. So filmmakers Catherine Fairfax Wright and Malika Zuhali Worrell decided to call their documentary Call Me Kuchu. British citizen Zuhali Worrell learned about the Kuchu community while working as a print and video journalist.
We heard about a transgender activist from Uganda called Victor Mukasa, who sued the Ugandan Attorney General for police harassment and won in a Ugandan court back in 2008. We were just intrigued to learn about that, while on the one hand the LGBT community were being persecuted by the government, on the other hand the judiciary was independent enough to recognise that even LGBT people deserve basic constitutional rights.
I'm the very first gay man to be open in Uganda. I'm a teacher by profession. I went to one of the best schools and here I am.
That's David Kato. He's the protagonist of Call Me Kuchu.
David especially understood the power of media to help relay their message, and especially the power of international media to kind of get their stories out there. And often in Uganda, the way to get the local media to write about an issue is to get it reported on CNN, for example, because then the local media can actually report on what CNN's reporting. If the local media reports on it directly, they're putting themselves more at risk.
Yesterday, gay rights activist David Katochisulu was attacked at his home by unknown assailants.
David is dead!
David Kato was murdered in January 2011. LGBT and human rights activists have attributed the murder to his sexuality. In August last year, the anti-homosexuality bill was shelved in the Ugandan parliament amid growing international criticism. However, it was retabled earlier this year, and authorities continue to clamp down on the LGBT community. Last week, British theatre producer David Cecil was arrested for putting on a play about a gay man. He was released on bail after a few days, but he faces up to 2 years imprisonment for allegedly promoting homosexuality. The same could happen to Zahali Worrell and Fairfax Wright if Call Me Kuchu is screened publicly in Uganda.
We're certainly not going to push for it to be screened in any capacity that the Kuchu community isn't comfortable with. But if they are and they really feel the need for it to be screened and the need for our presence or whatever, then, you know, we'll just go along with it as much as seems sensible.
Call Me Kuchu has been shown in the LGBT community in Uganda. Last month, it was privately screened during the country's first gay pride event, at which up to a dozen people were detained by the police. But apart from working on getting the film seen in Uganda, Zahali Worrell and Fairfax Wright are also looking into getting it screened in Nigeria, Kenya, and Ethiopia. Here in Germany, people can watch it at cinemas until December. So what do people think are the similarities and differences between the LGBT community here and the one in the film?
The film actually shows how much different is the perception of lesbian and gay people in Africa.
Here you can move more or less in freedom.
The parties are sometimes a little bit similar, but the rights are very different.
The partying and the strength and the feeling of being gay and lesbian.
50 years ago, it was not so different to the situation in Uganda, and I think we should be careful to judge other countries or African society.
And that's what Malika Zuhali Worrell and co-producer Catherine Fairfax Wright were trying to do.
Going beyond that narrative of victimization that was so omnipresent in the media, especially at least in the Western media, regarding this issue was really important to us. And, you know, that's kind of what we had thought we might find and what we had hoped to find. But, you know, it really did end up being what we saw to be the case, which was that, you know, this is a story of a people who are really putting their all into changing the situation before them.
Call Me Kuchu goes behind the headlines to show different aspects of the Ugandan LGBT community. And even though their lives are marked by the struggle against discrimination, we see that friendship, family, and religion, things that matter to other people too, are also just as important in their lives. Chiponda Chimbelu for DW in Bonn.
And I'm afraid that's all we have for you today. Thanks for listening to this week's edition of World in Progress. Remember, you can listen to the show or individual reports again. Just go to our website at dw.de/globalization. There, you'll also find more stories on development and globalization. Don't forget to tune in again next week. For today, on behalf of the studio team here in Bonn, I'm Sarah Steffen saying thanks for listening and goodbye for now. Tiraba, ze yali amanyi chibyo.